Welcome back for the third hour of Issues Etc. Open lines for the first 15 minutes here. We'll be talking with Pia De Soleni from the Family Research Council about Plan B, that emergency contraceptive, and what the FDA decided they were going to do with it last week. And then we'll be talking with Jennifer Roback Morse of the Hoover Institute about motherhood and the development of the baby's brain to round off the entire program and this hour of Issues Etc. today. It's open lines, anything you want to talk about. I've asked the question about what's the biggest challenge facing Christian moms today. Here, a few things that come to mind, even though I'm not a mom. How about balancing your kids and your husband? Some of these husbands, you know, these baby boomer husbands, have never left adolescence, and they require as much attention as small children, and they tend to pout when they don't get it, too. What about balancing work and family? We talked about working moms recently on Issues Etc. The financial constraints facing, you know, if 10% of your income goes to the church, Christian mothers might face a little bit different financial situation than non-Christian mothers. I have known Christian mothers whose family life and marriage was on the rocks, but they still show up for church meetings. They still go to their little small group meetings at church. They're trying to balance their family with their church as Christian mothers. 15 minutes of open lines, your questions and your comments. What challenges are you moms facing this day after Mother's Day? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We're also talking about whether or not Christians should support psychological torture if it means softening up those detainees that may have information. The targets, according to the Red Cross report, some of them, the 100 top high-value detainees, those people on the deck of cards from the Iraqi war. Let's go to the phones. Nancy's calling from St. Louis. Nancy, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi. Thank you. Well, I'd like to say that I think the Islams have won a battle over our spiritual standing and integrity because of the very fact I've never been in service or military. I do understand it's very gross and very ugly, and war is ugly. But I think it's very sad when you have to resort to that type of play or jesting, and when we, as a country of Christianity, are held high, and we have to the Islam country, we should set a higher standard. And not resort to that type of violence or degradation, I think, of nudity and also a humility of the Islamic soldier. I think it might be best if we could bring another entertainer. So I'm so sorry that Bob Hope has passed on, but we need to resort to a higher level of entertainment for these soldiers over there.
Yeah, especially Nancy, thank you, especially if they were doing this because they were bored. I mean, certainly there's something else they could be doing. I get the impression that these were not events that took place in the off hours of boredom. I get the impression that these were sometimes kind of the fraternity stunt, but at least the way the story is picking up, more often than not, these are soldiers who are ordered to do this as part of preparing people for interrogation. Now, they may have been given some latitude as to what they did, how they carried this out, but they believe they're doing it toward an end, toward the end of getting information. And I'm asking whether or not that's justified. Ellen is calling from Baldwin. Ellen, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Oh, hello, Pastor Wilkin. Well, I was sort of thinking the same thing, that was this torture done for the purpose of interrogation or a bunch of sickles having fun? Because one article I read said that these military people in that situation, they don't have to follow orders if it's totally against their conscience when they're asked to do certain things with prisoners.
You're right, Ellen. Actually, under any circumstances, if a soldier believes, it's not so much a matter of conscience, it's a matter of legality. If a soldier believes that what they're being ordered to do, regardless of the circumstances, is illegal,
uh-huh,
then he does have a recourse. to up the chain of command in order to check, is this what I've been ordered to do, and why am I being ordered to do it? And is there any recourse for me in that if I cannot carry out this order, because
that's
I do believe it to be
illegal? Well, there also, you know, one article talked about how they were cutting off animals' heads and they skinned the cow and all that. But there's one other little thought I've had, that this generation of these people, they have had an overdose of violence and sex on TV, movies, smut shops, the porno and garbage on the internet. To them, this, for some people, this would be recreation. It'd be probably not much different than what they enjoy doing for fun, you know, watching this sort of thing.
You're not saying that by way of making an excuse for their actions.
Oh, no. I mean, I think when I read, you know, when they say they should have a dishonorable discharge, I think they should have a dishonorable discharge and sit in jail for quite a few years.
Ellen, thank you so much for the call. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Let's see. Let's talk with Mary. She's calling from Collinsville. Mary, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, Pastor.
Hi, Mary.
I don't know if I can get through this, but you were talking about the hardest part.
Yeah.
About being a mother. I think it's probably, when you see your child walk away from the faith.
The hardest part of being a Christian mother is watching your children abandon the faith?
Absolutely.
Mary, thank you very much. Now, that takes the cake, doesn't it? And how many Christian mothers have watched precisely that very thing happen? You can hear the pain in Mary's voice. To watch their kids just walk away from the faith, to abandon it, the faith in which they were raised and nurtured. That's my highest prayer as a father. I can't speak to it as a mother, but my highest prayer the most frequent prayer that I have for my children is that God would sustain them in the Christian faith. Look, they don't have to grow up and make a lot of money. They don't have to grow up and be successful. They don't even have to grow up and marry well. You don't play these things off against one another, but the thing that I ask most often is that God would keep them in the Christian faith. And Mary's right. I mean, above all things, in the grand scope of things, that must be the most difficult thing of being a Christian mother, is watching your children abandon the Christian faith. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Jim is up. He's calling from his car. Jim, thanks for waiting.
Yes. Hi. A couple things. The last caller, that was right on the money. I love that. And I just raised my kids, and I pray that they will stay in the faith. What a blessing it would be in their lives. And second of all, I raised my children to have a higher power, that the Lord Jesus Christ is Lord of all. And that's how I raised my children, so that they know that, and they know that I sin, I fall short of Jesus' expectations, and that's why I need Jesus in my life for that forgiveness. And children today don't have that taught to them in the world. So when they go into war, who is the higher power? If their commanding officer says it's okay to mistreat these soldiers or these prisoners at this level, then nobody else is there to tell them that they're right or wrong, and they do what they want because they don't have a Lord that says that is not how you treat a human being created in the Lord's image.
Jim, thank you. Nicely tying those things together. Before we wrap up this conversation, I do want to have a few words in response to Mary's call about a conversation I had with an elderly woman who, even in her advanced age, was mourning the fact that one of her children, now this woman has already gone on to be with the Lord, but she was mourning the fact that one of her children had abandoned the Christian faith, actually had become a member of the Baha'i. And I recall that conversation. I'll share it with you in just a few minutes. Yeah, it's not just a matter of conscience. One of the things that I told my brother when he was ready to leave for Iraq, and my mother reminded him of this repeatedly and then left him with a little scripture verse that would remind him of this as well. Christ is going with you onto the battlefield. And that's not only a source of comfort, but it's also to remember whom you are serving ultimately in this capacity. Even if you pick up a gun and carry it into battle, who are you serving? Good thoughts, Jim. Judy's calling from her car. Judy, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, I just wanted to let Mary know that I've had children who have gone astray, nieces and nephews as well that I've raised, and I want her to know that this is the best time for her to keep praying and know that God is still in control. Even though they go far away, they know that God is still in control, and she needs to pray for that. That's all. Thank you.
All right, Judy, thank you. Oh, it's not just a matter of prayer, though. They're promises. We don't have to say, God, we know you're still in control, so you do its best. It's not just a matter of prayer. We pray on the basis of firm promises that God has made about our children and those children that he has made his own, that he has redeemed through the blood of Jesus Christ. God has made promises there. I'll get to that in just a second. Ron's calling from his car. Ron, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Enjoy your program.
Thank you.
I was thinking of a photo I saw during the Vietnam War of a little girl running that had been bombed with napalm.
Yes.
And then I remember the Lieutenant Kelly, the massacre. Those two things, I think, turned the tide of public opinion against any Vietnamese soldier to come home, and they were thought of as heinous people for even being in the Vietnam War. I think what these pictures and that has done is irreparable damage that... our soldiers that come home now from the Iraqi war would be looked at as some kind of savages or what have you. The harm, I don't know how Bush is going to do damage control on this. And I don't know what these people had in their mind, but the damage they have done is just beyond calculation. That's all I had to say.
Ron, thank you. Oh, yeah, it could have been worse. It could have been worse. We could have seen pictures of like we saw from Vietnam. We didn't see pictures like that. But we saw things that showed Americans at their worst, the American soldier at their worst, and not at their best. And it remains to be seen how a commander-in-chief will deal with this. And it remains to be seen how the United States will answer the implicit charge that this is who we really are. These pictures reveal the truth about us. The rest of it is just a bunch of nonsense of the claims that we are humane and dignified and care about human rights all fall away when we see these pictures. That is the answer that needs to come. Now, I had this conversation with an elderly woman out in California. She had been living for years with a great sadness in her life. This is a woman who had suffered cancer. She was still in the midst of suffering cancer. She went in regularly for chemotherapy. It caused her great pain. She had lost her husband several years before, her dearly beloved husband. She had endured many things in her long life, and now in her 80s, the greatest sorrow of her life remained unresolved. It was that her daughter had become a Baha'i, a daughter that she had raised in a Christian family, in the Christian church, listening to the gospel of Jesus Christ, had raised in the Christian faith under those promises, train up a child in the way that they should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. Under those promises that everyone that Christ makes a sheep through the water of holy baptism, he will by no means leave, and that even the Father holds them firmly in his grasp. Suddenly, this little sheep, her daughter, had decided she wasn't going to listen to the shepherd's voice. She was going to listen to the voice of Satan, the Baha'i. The only thing I could say to her, God loves your children more than you love them. I want Mary to hear this too. God loves your children more than you even love them. And God's promise is strong. It's stronger than your love. God's promise that no one will snatch them out of your hand is strong. He has put the pledge of that promise into this person's life through the water of holy baptism. He's made them his child. Now God says, that's my child. His grief over their straying away is greater even than yours, O mother. And that means, and he can do something about it, he can bring those straying sheep home. We have a good shepherd who makes it his business to bring back sheep who stray. That's the promise we hold on to. Jesus Christ, our good shepherd. Now, earlier today, I interviewed Pia de Soleni about about Plan B, the emergency contraception. I began by asking her to distinguish between Plan B and RU486.
The Plan B, or what's called the morning after pill, sometimes it's called emergency contraception, is basically a very high dosage of regular oral contraceptives. And what it does one of three things. And it depends where a woman is at in her menstrual cycle. It can prevent her from ovulating, or if she's ovulated, it can prevent the egg and the sperm it can prevent conception. Or if conception has already occurred, it can prevent that new life, that tiny little embryo, from attaching to the walls of the embryo, because the walls of the embryo, in essence, become hard. So the embryo is, in fact, starved. So it does one of three things. Our biggest problem is with the last one. If this woman has already ovulated, then chances of conception are very, very high. In that case, then, this is working as an abortifacient. Now, it's different from the RU46. RU46 is used when the pregnancy is more advanced, up to, I believe it's 6 weeks, and it is a chemical procedure to cause a miscarriage. So the baby, in that case, the embryo or the baby is already attached in the womb and growing, developing. It's 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 6 weeks old, and in that case, the drugs work to cause a miscarriage and stopping the pregnancy when it's further along. But both of them, it depends when you define pregnancy. What they're trying to do in this debate is say, oh, pregnancy isn't until the embryo attaches to the uterus. And you know what? From day one, we always said pregnancy was, you know, you get an egg and a sperm and you have a baby. And guess what? That's pregnancy.
Pia, tell us about the decision Thursday last week that was taken by the FDA.
Basically, the FDA said that Bar Laboratories which is the company that is producing Plan B, that their studies were inadequate in order to make Plan B an over-the-counter medication. Over-the-counter means you don't need a prescription for it. You can get it get it just as you'd get your toothpaste and Coca-Cola or your beauty products, whatever, you know. And the problem is that the studies that they submitted only involved 29 young women aged 16 and under. And of those, not one was 14 and under. So we don't have the data to say that this drug is conclusively safe for these young women. Furthermore, Bar Laboratories needs to come up with a plan. If you can't distribute it to these young people, how are you going to keep them from getting it?
Okay, I'd like your reaction to several advocates of this Plan B and their reaction to the FDA's decision that was taken last week. First, from the New England Journal of Medicine. This comes from the editor of the journal and two members of the FDA advisory panel that supported the application for this drug to be over-the-counter. They said, the decision-making process is being influenced by political considerations. Although the FDA is frequently criticized by politicians and others for being either too lenient or too tough, the integrity of the process has seldom been questioned. To squander that trust by allowing political pressure to delay a decision to make safe and effective emergency contraception available over the counter seems to us a serious error. Your response?
Well, first of all, I think the FDA acknowledged that it has a liability. You know, if the FDA is going to approve a drug, whether for prescription or over the counter, they have to ensure that it's safe. The data that Bar Laboratories provided does not assure them that it's a safe drug, particularly for young women, for women age 16 and under. So it's that's a huge liability issue for the FDA. I don't think that they could have acted otherwise. Secondly, you know, this is, unfortunately, whenever we get into the abortion debate or anything that has to do with abortion, the other side is always saying, well, you know, it's politics versus science. Well, when science trumps, or when you actually have the science in front of you, they don't want to hear it. They still want to stick to the political and to their political ideology, and we've got to move beyond that. The science so far cannot ensure that this is, in fact, safe medication. Secondly, it's not always just a contraceptive. Sometimes it can be an abortifacient. So until science clarifies some of these points, there's no way that the FDA can promote it.
A different but a similarly negative reaction came from Kirsten Moore, director of the Reproductive Health Technologies Project. She said,
Yes, the data on women 16 and under is limited, but that's because the use is very limited. Is she telling the truth?
Well, that's not the truth in the UK. In the UK, where the morning after pill has been readily available, numerous young girls, I mean as young as 10 and 11, have been taking it. So if it's available, they will take it. And, you know, I think her statement is completely irrelevant. The fact is you make it available and they'll take it.
So if the FDA were to approve this application for over-the-counter sale, there is nothing the FDA could do then to keep girls 16 and under from going in and buying Plan B.
That's right. And, you know, I think we need to take this a step further and realize that, you know, all the data that's been generated, I mean, I think it's either Secrets or Alan Guttmacher Institute. And these are, you know, institutes that identify themselves as pro-abortion. Their data indicates that young women, their first sexual encounter, 25% of them say it was unwanted. Now, they don't say coerced, but they say unwanted. So we're just, you know, when we make things like contraception and the morning after pill readily available, we're making it easier for these young girls to be compromised. And in the case where you're dealing with a sexual predator, you're making it easier for him to take advantage of a young woman.
The campaign for Democratic presidential candidate Senator John Kerry has also issued a statement, quote, "Women's health should not be held hostage to election year politics and pandering to anti-choice extremists. In this White House, politics trumps sound science every time." Your response, Pia?
Again, I think it's a low blow. I really do. You know, and I think the senator himself should take the time to be briefed on the data that's out there and the concerns that are being raised, but it's an absolute low blow.
What's the current status with the FDA of RU486 that you described before?
It's available as a prescription. And right now, that's being contended and being challenged, but that challenge, as far as I know, has not progressed. And I want to emphasize, too, you know, a young woman can't get low-level hormonal birth control, like the pill. She can't get that over the counter. She has to get a prescription for it. Any adult woman has to have a prescription for regular birth control. Why then would we make it easier for them to get an over-the-counter prescription for something that's much higher, much more concentrated, and potentially much more harmful?
Finally, if you would, Pia, make the case then that the FDA's decision, as preliminary as it is last week, to keep Plan B, the emergency contraceptive, from going over the counter to women and to girls, make the case that that was the right thing for the FDA to do.
First of all, they didn't have the data to establish that it was safe and that it was good for women. And until we can do that, they have no choice, I think, but to ask our laboratories to provide more information if they want to proceed with this plan. And then secondly, you know, there's the moral concerns. And I think a lot of our listeners are very concerned about protecting women and also protecting the lives of unborn children. And many of us understand that you can't talk about just one or the other. When you're talking about a mother, then you're talking about a child. When you're talking about a child, you have to talk about a mother. And we understand that those two their lives are inextricably united. And yeah, there can be pregnancies that are difficult. There can be situations that aren't great. But we want real answers. And this is a Band-Aid cure. It doesn't solve the problem.
Pia DeSeleni, thank you again for being our guest on Issues Etc.
It's a pleasure. Thanks so much.
That's Pia DeSeleni. She's Director of Life and Women's Issues for the Family Research Council based in Washington, D.C., talking about the FDA's rejection Thursday of the over-the-counter sale of this contraceptive called Plan B. When we come back from this break, we'll be talking with Jennifer Roback Morse about motherhood and the development of the baby's brain. Is it important to society itself, to the culture, that women spend time with their children when their children are small? Jennifer Roback Morse of the Hoover Institute. After this break, stay tuned for the last 25 minutes of Issues Etc.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Jesus tells his opponents in John chapter 5, "You search the scriptures because you think that by them you have eternal life. These are the scriptures that testify about me." What did Jesus mean? Our Issues Etc. book of the month for May is titled, "Why I Am a Lutheran, Jesus at the Center." It's written by Issues Etc. regular guest Pastor Daniel Preuss. For more information on the book, visit our website, issuesetc.org, and click the What's New section. Why I Am a Lutheran is published by Concordia Publishing House. 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. What does it mean that Jesus is the Alpha and the Omega? Find out with Why I Am a Lutheran, Jesus at the Center, by Pastor Daniel Preuss. The cost is $12.99 plus shipping and handling. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org. Why I Am a Lutheran, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May.
Jaxies, an example of created kinds.
Answers with Ken Ham, author of the new free booklet, The Seven Seas of History. Well, Ken, what on earth is a Jaxie, and what does it have to do with the Bible's created kinds?
You see, we often hear critics claim that there were too many species of animals for Noah to fit on the ark. But you know, there's a big difference between the biblical created kind and what we call a species. For example, consider the wild dogs of Africa called jackals. They have a much sharper sense of smell than domestic dogs, but are less willing to be put to work. So a Russian research group crossed a jackal with a husky to breed the ultimate sniffer dog. They call it a Jaxie. Now, 25 of the new breed are used at a Moscow airport to sniff out drugs and explosives in planes and luggage. This shows again that the Bible's created kinds often include more than one species. It also shows that the selective breeding that produced domestic dogs also removed some genetic information. In the case of the husky, it lost its great sense of smell. This is just another one of the many examples of how wolves, jackals, coyotes, dingoes, and other dog varieties easily interbreed with the domestic dog, showing that although they may be classed as different species, they're really all one created kind. So you see, Noah only needed two dogs, representing the dog kind on the ark.
Noah's Ark is one of the major themes of Ken Ham's new free booklet, The Seven Seas of History. His various booklets are available free when you go to AnswersRadio.com.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. Children surfing the net can accidentally come across sites that are racist, violent, or pornographic. Some sites will even bribe your child with the promise of free prizes in exchange for personal information. Some sites may even try to arrange personal meetings with your child. Software filters can be helpful in blocking out unwanted sites. But there is no substitute for keeping your home computer in a central location so you can easily monitor where your children are going online. Remember, God loves our children so much that He sent Jesus to die for them, and He also guards and protects them from sin and every evil. And one way He does that is through the watchful eyes of Christian parents. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute. Please visit our website at cmli.org.
Hope Lutheran Church and School in St. Louis is an underwriter of Issues Etc. Hope Lutheran is located at 5218 Neosho in St. Louis. Randy Asbury and Stephen Rosebrock are the pastors. Their phone number, 314-352-0014, 352-0014. Hope Lutheran Church and School in St. Louis, www.hopelutheranstl.org. www.hopelutheranstl.org. Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we're going to discuss women and vocation, mother, wife, in the workplace, all sorts of callings that women find themselves in. They just don't find themselves in. They are called by God to occupy those roles in life. We'll talk about it tomorrow with a roundtable. Our panelists will be Kathy Schultz, Linda Preuss, and Sally Hendrickson tomorrow on Issues Etc. For the last 25 minutes of the program, Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse joins us. We're going to be talking about motherhood and the development of a baby's brain. Jennifer Roback Morse is a research fellow at the Hoover Institute. She's author of the book, Love and Economics, Why the Laissez-Faire Family Doesn't Work. Before we get into that conversation, I'd like two of our callers from the hour of open lines to call us back. First of all, Marty, if you would call us back, I'd like to send you Dr. John Warwick Montgomery's book called Human Rights and Human Dignity. It's a value there, and it's absolutely free for you, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Then on the question of motherhood, I'd like Mary to call back, if she would, at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. I'd like to have you give you a copy of Carolyn Graglia's book called Domestic Tranquility, A Brief Against Feminism, absolutely free as well. Both of you, Marty and Mary, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Oh, it's become a cliche, hasn't it? How did that Michael Jackson song go? We are the world. I believe that children are the future. Teach them well and let them lead the way. Show them all the beauty they possess inside or something like that. Remember this? We are the world. We are the children. Children are the future. That's a statement that no one can argue with. I'm certainly not the future. I can only last so long. My kids will outlast me, God willing. So, yes, children are the future, but let's talk about children today. Yes, they are the future. But every child needs a mother. Children without the benefits of a regular contact with their mother, the right kind of contact mothers should have with their children, are going to give us a very different future than children that have mothers that care and that raise their children accordingly. We're going to talk about a future, the future of a free and secure society, and motherhood with Jennifer Roback Morse. She has also written a column for magazine titled Science Discovers. I'm sorry, the column is titled Science Discovers the Importance of Motherhood. Jennifer, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Glad to be here.
Jennifer, you say that the future of a secure and free society depends on mothers. What do you mean?
Well, it turns out that the free society needs people with a conscience. And in order to have a conscience, you really need to have the foundation for the conscience laid by being in relationship with your mother. We sometimes think that having a conscience means knowing right from wrong and being able to explain the rules and respond to the rules and the punishments and all that sort of thing. But actually, that comes in way, way later in a child's development. What a child first needs to have is a basic attachment and connection to his mother, which lays the groundwork for even caring what's right and what's wrong, and it lays the groundwork for his relationships and attachments to other people in the future. And children who do not have that tend to have a very difficult time having self-control, having conscience development, and basically participating in a social order and being sociable creatures, so that initial, you know, 6 to 9 to 18 month period of time in a child's life is extremely important, not because of anything you're saying to the child, not because of any intellectual development, but because of the importance of the relationship itself.
So this contact, and let's talk in more detail about the kind of contact that you're talking about with children at those formative years, determines to a large degree the conscience and the ability to act upon conscience when they become adults, ergo society will either benefit or not benefit
right
from these children come adults.
That's right. In fact, I heard one child development person say that civilization depends on a good first year. And that's what he was talking about, you know, that in order to have a civilized society, you need people being able to follow the rules and conform themselves to the basic norms of society in order to not bother other people too much, you know, in order to make it possible for people to go about their business and use freedom in a way that's not harmful to other people. Well, that takes place, the ability to do that takes place in the first year. And what happens is that when a baby is born, they don't really have a good sense of themselves as separate from their mother. And so what will happen in the normal course of development is that as the baby is the mom is rocking the baby and holding the baby and feeding the baby and carrying the baby around and changing diapers and all those kinds of things that are really very ordinary. You know, there's no rocket science here. It's all very ordinary. What she's doing is the baby is looking out at her and she is looking back at the baby. And that is, first of all, helping the child to have a sense that the world is a safe place in which he can live and thrive. It's helping to have a sense of himself as a separate being, as somehow separate from his mother. You know, he's connected to his mother, but he's not the same as his mother. And when you see children who do not have that basic relationship with a mother, when you see children raised in orphanages or children who are abused by their parents or left for long periods of time, left alone and really their basic needs being neglected, when you see kids like that, the kinds of things that they get into is that they do not have a good sense of itself, first of all. They're insecure and threatened a lot of the time, but a lot of the time the way they'll act that out is by being aggressive towards others, and they just really don't get that they're a problem to other people. And you can talk to your blue in the face about how, gee, you know, you wouldn't like it if he did that to you, don't do that. And they don't care. It doesn't matter to them that other people are unhappy with them or that they've harmed another person. And that ability to really connect and care and have some empathy for the other person, that is a part of what the mother is doing there in a very visceral, nonverbal way. That groundwork is being laid.
Now, you have observed that there's not a lot metaphysical about this. We're not talking about some little magical pixie dust that mom can sprinkle on her kid. This is about brain development. This
yes.
is about basic needs of human beings in these formative years and while the brain continues to develop after birth. Tell us about it.
Yes, that was the most fascinating thing to me. You know, I've talked on this program before about my own experience adopting a child who'd been in an orphanage for a long time. And in our experience, we thought of it pretty much as the way I just described it to you. We just kind of talked about it in psychological terms and so on. But we've since discovered that neuroscience has discovered that the brain develops by being in relationship with somebody, with your mommy, you know, most normally with your mommy. They're separate. They're different parts to the brain. We usually think of brain development having to do with the part that does math and logic and all that kind of stuff, the front part of the brain, the neocortex. But there's another part of the brain that's called the limbic brain that allows people to have emotional responses to others. It's the part of the brain that allows you to look at another person and kind of judge how they feel by looking at their face. It's the part of the brain that makes a hug feel good, you know, being in a relationship, it turns out, is a physiological event and has physiological consequences. And so that part of the brain that governs so much of your emotional life and so much of your ability to be empathetic, that part of your brain is the part that develops after birth while being in relationship with your mom. And if the baby, whether it's a baby human or a baby monkey, if they're isolated from a caregiver, a real person, you know, taking care of them, whether it's a monkey person or a human person, depending on their species, if they live in isolation, it's empathy that they can't do. It's caring for others. It's noticing others. It's the emotional, social component of their lives that turns out to be really thwarted. And so what they're seeing, what the scientists are seeing, is that this development of this part of the brain not only governs your emotional life or your ability to be in relations with others, but it also becomes developed by being in the process of being in relationship with your mom. So it's a causality that goes both directions. You know, by being with your mom, you develop more ability to be in satisfactory relationships with other people.
What implications would this have to your way of thinking, Jennifer? For issues like daycare, where in some cases, in a lot of cases, infant children in these early years are subjected to repeated long periods of time daily away from mother. What implications would that have for a future of a secure and free society?
I'll tell you something, that one of the things that people track in these studies of daycare is that they track what they call attachment. You know, does daycare affect the extent to which children attach to their parents? And there is evidence that that too long in daycare, too early in your life, can impair your ability to attach to others. Now, of course, it doesn't do it to everybody, and defenders of daycare will be quick to jump up and say, well, most kids are attached, and the studies prove it. Nah, nah, nah. But the studies also show that more kids in daycare have more problems with attachment than kids who aren't in daycare. And that's the thing you have to look at. What you are doing, what we have to look at as parents, as individual parents, is that when we put our kids in daycare, we're taking a calculated risk, and we need to monitor that with our own kids and say, well, you know, is this baby allowing me to hold him? Is this baby turning his face away when I go to snuggle with him? Is this baby really responding when I hold him and snuggle with him and stuff like that? And all of those things are very very important markers or of the child's reaction. And if your kid is having trouble in daycare, then you need to get them out of daycare, and you need to say the heck with whatever the experts or the studies say. And that would be the main thing that I would say to parents in particular. But as a society in general, I think that we're really taking a very serious risk here in assuming that daycare could be or ought to be the norm for all kids all the time. That's really a mistake.
Someone's going to say, look, Jennifer, I understand that the bad daycare is bad daycare, and no one wants that for their children. But, you know, my husband and I, we spend a lot of money to make sure we get top-quality daycare. And, yes, it is lengthy periods of time. We live with the constant guilt of that, of course. But, you know, these people there are genuinely caring. These people there, we're not warehousing our kids. This is top-notch, top-drawer daycare.
You have to ask yourself, what does high-quality daycare mean? You know, and again, don't pay attention to the experts as much as you pay attention to your kid. You know, what's going on with your child himself or herself? What's going on with the child? And I don't care how high-quality the daycare is. If your child's having problems, then you need to deal with that, you know. But the issue, I think, more than anything else, is the physical contact with a person. What's going to happen if you really, truly have high-quality daycare? What's going to happen is that your child is going to have their primary attachment figure be somebody other than you. That's what's going to happen, because they need to have a primary attachment figure. And if you're okay with it being the nanny, or if you're okay with it being the daycare worker, then that's fine. But that is what you're saying, and that is what's going to happen, because they have to attach to somebody. And they're going to attach, if they're going to attach at all, it's going to be to the person that's spending the most time with them and that's really holding on to them and all that kind of stuff. So I think that is the point where a lot of working moms get off the bus. You know, that's when they say, okay, that's it. I don't want my kid attaching to somebody else. I want to be the primary person. And that, of course, is easy to understand, too.
Now, that bears repeating, Jennifer, because what you've just said there is the argument for high-quality daycare, basically, if you're going to be consistent with it, would say, okay, yes, I am conceding the basic attachment of my child that they need so desperately in those early years to someone other than me.
Right.
And if I argue for high-quality daycare, where they are going to be carrying and cooing and playing and all of these things that we've been talking about here, it's not going to be to me that my kid's going to latch on.
That's right. That's right. And that's tough to take. And I think that the importance of these neurobiological studies is for us to understand that we really are hardwired to attach. We are hardwired to connect with other people. And I think women in particular have been sold a bill of goods on this. We're taught to believe that that the most worthy thing to be doing is to be out in the workforce where we're being independent and we're being self-sufficient and all that sort of thing. But the fact of the matter is that the human species is hardwired to connect with other people. That doesn't mean we're destined to be socialists or live in a kibbutz. That's not what I'm talking about. But it does mean that the connection that you feel with your baby is natural. It's hardwired into you, and it's not something you should apologize for or feel badly about. It's also true that when you get frustrated with your kid, that's easy. That's pretty natural too. So I don't want people to go away thinking that, you know, that there's something wrong with them if they don't feel anything for their baby. But on the whole, people do feel something, and on the whole, women dropping their kids off at daycare are in tears themselves a lot of the time, and we have been told by society that those tears and that pain that we feel as mothers, that we're supposed to accept that pain in the name of women's equality in the workforce. And I hope that women will come to understand that they are not required to accept that pain if they don't want to, you know, that you're not required to go back to work when your baby's 6 weeks old, that the pain you feel is genuine and it's hardwired into you to feel something for your baby, and in fact, the society and the culture and the civilization depends on you feeling that towards your baby. That's the kind of creatures we are. We're made to connect so that we will take care of one another, because we absolutely need this as a species that comes into the world so helpless as we do. We need this feeling. We need for it to feel good to take care of one another, and that's not a bad thing. That's a good thing.
Jennifer, is the future now, are we already seeing the effects of children who have not had this basic need for connection met within the family? Are we seeing that already in society today?
Oh, sure we are. But we're seeing it on two different levels, Todd, so I don't want to be alarmist about this. It is true that we have an overlarge prison population, in part because the kids are not having their needs met. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And so that's an important element of what's going on, and that has to do with daycare. It has to do with unmarried mothers. Probably more than any single thing has to do with unmarried mothers, divorced parents, and stuff like that. Most kids, most boys in the juvenile justice system come from fatherless families. Okay, so that's probably the key variable there. Not the motherless family, but the fatherless family. So the father's an important component to it. But the other thing that we're seeing, Todd, is that kids who grew up in daycare, who grew up with mothers and fathers divorcing and remarrying and so on and so forth, all of that kind of instability that they had in their lives, the kids who were not devastated by it but were still injured by it, those people are growing up and having kids of their own, and what I'm hearing from them is that they want something better for their own kids. They are not satisfied with daycare and divorce and remarriage. They want to get married and stay married, and they want to stay home. There are more there are more young moms staying at home now than there used to be, and in part, I think, it's because they are reacting to what they had to deal with in their own childhood, and they want something better for their kids.
Jennifer, you have written this: too many of us see the primary business of parenthood as transferring resources from big people to little people. What is the primary business of motherhood and of fatherhood, for that matter?
The primary business of parenthood is building relationships. The primary business of motherhood and fatherhood is relational. Has nothing to do with transferring resources around. And the reason that's important to see is that many of our social policies are based on the idea that what kids need are food and clothes and shelter. And so what we have to do is make it possible for the kids to have their food and their clothes and their shelter. We have to have programs for this or that or the third thing. But those kids who have those kinds of, they have those kinds of material needs being met, that doesn't mean that their relational needs are being met. And many of the programs that we established really were based on the idea that what we have to do is get resources to kids, and we're not really paying attention to the fact that the relationships are much more important to the kids than the resources. And so moms and dads are important because they're feeding their kids, that's important, but in the process of feeding their kids, they're building a relationship with that child as well. The mom, you know, at the most primal infant level, the mom is the source of nourishment. She's the source of comfort. She's the source of everything sweet. You know, the mother's milk is sweet and nurturing and comforting, and that all becomes associated with a person and being in relationship with another person. And it's just not the same as having a bottle wired to your crib and you suck on it when you feel like it, you know. And that's just as starkly as I can put the difference, you know, is that how the resources are delivered is extremely important. And if we disrupt the family relationships, we've really done a lot of harm in delivering resources.
You have also observed that, again, kind of putting it starkly, this becomes a competition between adult self-fulfillment and the demanding work of raising our kids. To round off our conversation, give us your final thoughts on that.
Well, I think we don't let ourselves see the real fulfillment that's possible in the business of taking care of kids and being in relationship. And we think of ourselves in isolation from others, then we tend to think about our own goals and our own feelings and our own needs and that sort of thing, and we miss the real possibilities for ourselves as well. So, ironically, in the business of saying, well, we're going to fulfill our own needs at the expense of the kids, we don't fulfill our own needs as well as we otherwise would, because we misunderstand who we are as persons. The fact is that the human person is made to be in relationship with others, and we're really missing out on a lot if we don't see that.
Folks, you can read Jennifer Roback Morse's column called Science Discovers the Importance of Motherhood on the web at tothesource.org, tothesource, all one word, www.issuesetc.org. Jennifer Roback Morse, thank you for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Glad to be here.
Jennifer Roback Morse is a research fellow at the Hoover Institute. She's author of the book Love and Economics, Why the Laissez-Faire Family Doesn't Work. We have a great book to recommend to you folks. This one, it's simple, it's straightforward, it's handy, and it's eminently practical, while being at the same time, and this should be no surprise, eminently Christ-centered and cross-focused. We love that here at Issues, etc. Christ-centered, cross-focused. The book is called Why I Am a Lutheran, Jesus at the Center. It's our Issues, etc. book of the month for May. You know, May is the month, it's my birthday month. I'm going to be 40 years old. I'm hoping someone, some kind soul, will pick up the Issues, etc. book of the month for me. It's only $12.99 plus shipping and handling. It's called Why I Am a Lutheran, Jesus at the Center. Its author is a regular guest here on Issues, etc., Pastor Daniel Preuss. With Christ at the center of Holy Scripture and all Christian teaching, it should be no wonder that the true Christian faith has at its center Jesus. That's the answer to the question, Why I Am a Lutheran. $12.99 plus shipping and handling. You can order it by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours. That's 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. You can also browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org, the website address, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section, scroll down, you'll find the Issues, Etc. book of the month, Why I Am a Lutheran, Jesus at the Center, by Pastor Daniel Preuss there. You can also visit one of the two locations that Concordia Publishing House has here in St. Louis, one here on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton. Just follow the signs to the Concordia Publishing House bookstore and look for the book, Why I Am a Lutheran, Our Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for May, or at 3558 South Jefferson in St. Louis. That's at the intersection of Miami and Jefferson. Look there for the Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for May. Now, when you go in or when you call or when you write, make sure you mention Issues, Etc. It's our Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for May. Why I Am a Lutheran, Jesus at the Center, by regular guest here on Issues, Etc., Pastor Daniel Preuss. Oh, by the way, Daniel's wife, Linda, will be one of our guests tomorrow during our panel discussion of Women on Vocation, along with Sally Hendrickson and Kathy Schultz. Linda Preuss, Sally Hendrickson, Kathy Schultz will be our guest as we talk about women and the roles that they have rolling along with the issue of motherhood. We'll also not only be talking about motherhood, but about being a wife, being someone who works. All of that tomorrow on Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.